Record-setting cold in Texas might be bearable if people still had heat and power.
Half of our population is without power water right now.
What were supposed to be rolling blackouts because of high demand here have now turned into outages of more than 24 hours.
It's insane. Like, I've been here for about 30 years and I've never seen nothing like this.
We are going to have to restructure to make sure that situations like this never occur again.
Millions of Texans woke up this morning still without power. Winter storms have brought snow, ice, and the coldest temperatures in decades. Texas is the only state that operates its own power grid, and it has not been able to keep up with the demand for heat. But power problems brought about by natural disasters aren't just a Texas problem. Here in California, we've had our fair share of blackouts from wildfires and heat waves. They're both examples of how the country's aging power grids cannot keep up with the growing demand of weather disasters caused by climate change. Joining us to talk about this is Leah Stokes. She's a researcher on energy policy and a professor at UC Santa Barbara. Welcome.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on.
Well, it's great to have you. So a lot of the central United States is experiencing these low temperatures, but Texas is having the biggest problem dealing with the cold snap in terms of supplying power. And is that because it has its own grid?
In part, yes. And you can see that because there's a part of Texas that I think we're going to talk about, El Paso, that's not connected to what's called ERCOT, which is basically Texas's own grid, and they're doing just fine. And so Texas has maintained a kind of sovereign grid that doesn't have a lot of interconnections into other parts of the country. And so that means if they have scarcity, because, for example, their gas plants aren't working very well with the cold temperatures, they can't very easily import power from other places because the grid is not very interconnected with other parts of the country.
So El Paso was able to import power from elsewhere?
Yeah, El Paso is a part of Texas that does not function under ERCOT. And so they are part of other parts of the country's power grid. And they also, after experiencing extreme weather about a decade ago, made investments to make sure that their infrastructure would be able to keep operating during a kind of extreme weather that we are seeing right now.
Well, I guess that is the key. What kinds of investments would need to happen to make the rest of the power supply, still function during an extreme weather emergency? Texas, I believe, is prepared for extreme heat, but not for extreme cold. What would it take to make it prepared for extreme cold?
Well, it's important to note that we're just seeing more and more of these extreme weather events, whether it's heat waves that go across the western United States like we experienced last summer, or this kind of breakdown in the polar vortex leading to massive plunges in temperatures throughout the Midwest and Texas. And both of these, scientists believe, are linked to climate change. And so we know that climate change is stressing out our infrastructure, and it's just harder to plan when you have so much variability and extremes in weather events. But there are investments that can be made to keep our electricity infrastructure operating even during times of extreme events. And those investments just haven't been made in Texas, in part because of the way Texas's electricity system works, which is that it's a competitive market. And so there isn't a lot of centralized planning to make sure that there's adequacy for power, 365 days a year.
Right. So they want to keep the rates low and by investing in shoring them up to make them ready to handle what is an extreme event. I mean, they're saying that they haven't seen these temperatures in decades. That would add a lot of money to customers' power bills, and maybe that's not considered a worthy investment.
Yeah, I think you could say things like that. But I think we're seeing that climate change is having us experience so much more of these extreme weather events, and these investments make sense. So, for example, Texas has some of the worst energy efficiency policies in the country. There hasn't been a lot of money going into, for example, weatherizing homes so that they're more insulated. And if we had more of that in Texas, then people would be in a lot safer situation right now, because if you have a very well-insulated home that uses energy more efficiently, first of all, we wouldn't need as much electricity in the first place. And secondly, if it got cold and the power went out, your home wouldn't lose the heat as quickly. So there are are a lot of common sense solutions that we have, like energy efficiency, that Texas really has not been investing in.
Well, what about here in California? We have problems of our own with our electricity supply and the fact that we experience not only rolling blackouts during extreme events, but blackouts or power failures pretty regularly here in California. What's the problem?
Yes, we sure do. And, you know, climate change is a big culprit when it comes to California struggling to manage its electricity system as well. So people will probably remember the terrible blackouts and the fires from the summer. What happened is that there was a terrible heat wave that hit the entire western United States, which led to a lot of scarcity in the amount of power that we had in Arizona or in Nevada or in California. And because we share resources, if there's a heat wave in Arizona that's spiking electricity demand for air conditioning, that's also going to affect California. So this just shows us how our infrastructure is so vulnerable under climate change. And keep in mind, we've only warmed the planet by about 1 degree centigrade so far. What's it going to be like when we continue on this trajectory, when we continue to see terrible fires leading to public safety power shutoffs, where electricity is turned off in kind of anticipation of wind events? What's going to happen when we keep having these horrible heat waves? You know, we really have to look squarely at the challenge of climate change and how much it's stressing out our electricity infrastructure.
Well, the leadership here in California is they're not climate deniers, climate change deniers, and in fact, quite the opposite. So what are they doing to try to upgrade the grid as it affects California's power?
Well, there are investments going in to try to make the grid more resilient. You could, for example, put power lines underground as one way to avoid having to do shutoffs in a preemptive way when there's a lot of wildfire risk. But that is enormously expensive to do. Mm-hmm. And it's not clear that we necessarily have the resources to invest in that scale of undergrounding. And when we have extreme heat, for example, it means that many gas plants, fossil fuel plants, go offline. Just like when we have extreme cold, as is what's happening in Texas right now, gas plants, they freeze and they can't continue to operate. So a lot of the challenges with climate change are not somehow about renewable energy or something like that. They're actually about fossil fuel infrastructure being stressed out under extreme weather. It's kind of like if you've ever been at an airport and we have an extreme heat day, which are happening more and more because of climate change, airplanes cannot take off. And it's the same sort of thing that's happening right now to our fossil fuel infrastructure. The irony is that these fossil fuels have caused climate change, but now climate change is making it impossible for them to even operate. So these are really big challenges. And I think they just underscore how urgent it is for us to get off fossil fuels, because it's really destabilizing our infrastructure across the board.
Although in Texas, about 20%, 23%, I believe, of the electricity comes from wind, and those turbines were frozen as well.
Very few wind turbines were frozen, and it's unfortunate how much amplification there has been of misinformation. Wind in the early days of the outages was actually overperforming what was expected to be happening. And at that time, 30 gigawatts of gas was offline. Mm-hmm. The more recent data is that perhaps about 2 times as much gas is offline than wind. And I think we have to ask ourselves, you know, the same kinds of lies were perpetuated when California had challenges during the heat waves. For example, the Wall Street Journal editorial board penned a piece claiming that it was green energy. They have now penned a piece about Texas saying that it's green energy. And these are just lies that are being perpetuated by certain right-wing media sources that are not based in reality.
Okay, so final analysis, you think that renewables would do a better job at protecting the supply of energy during a crisis?
Well, we need all of our infrastructure to be resilient, but I think there's been an assumption in the electricity world that somehow gas can be turned on at any moment and it's the most reliable source. And we're seeing how during climate change, when we have extreme heat waves and a breakdown in the polar vortex leading to extreme cold events, that that isn't true, that gas infrastructure can struggle to perform under these extreme events. There are, of course, things that we can do for both gas infrastructure and for renewables to make them more resilient. But overall, you know, this isn't an issue of somehow clean energy causing the problem. The root cause of extreme weather events is fossil fuels, and we really need to be clear-eyed about that.
Leah, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Leah Stokes, she's a researcher on energy policy at UC Santa Barbara and author of the book Short Circuiting Policy, Interest Groups and the Battle Over Clean Energy and Climate Policy in the American States. Well, Governor Gavin Newsom has more political problems on his hands now. About half a dozen companies that made big donations to him got special treatment from the state to help it deal with the pandemic. That's according to a new investigation from Capital Public Radio. Companies like United Health, Blue Shield of California, Bloom Energy, some of them got big no-bid contracts. Others had their leaders appointed to high-profile positions. Experts say no laws appear to have been broken, no quid pro quo. But the overlap between these companies' donations to the governor and the preferential treatment they seem to have received from the state, well, not great optics for Newsom, especially as he stares down a recall effort. Capital Public Radio's Scott Rodd reported on this story, and he's here to talk about it. Hi there.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. All right. So you looked at these companies and how they contributed to Newsom in one way or another. And what did you find?
So I found that companies that contributed tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands of dollars in late 2019 and into 2020 and into 2021 also received no-bid contracts during the state's response to the coronavirus pandemic. And as you mentioned, a couple of them also received either appointments to task forces that helped determine state policy in terms of responding to the pandemic, as well as assistance with, in one example, what appeared to be a timeline that showed shortly after contributions, a hospital that the company operated that was decommissioned was then shortly thereafter reopened. So that timeline is sort of what the reporting documents. And as you mentioned, I think it's very important to note, government ethics experts say, you know, there's no evidence here of criminal wrongdoing, of quid pro quo, anything like that. But the timelines do raise significant red flags, things that concerns about just the timing of these things is what experts said.
Hmm. Well, give us an example and talk about one company, Bloom Energy. And this is a high tech company. I think it's based in San Jose, that is a fuel cell maker. And then they were asked to make or refurbish ventilators.
That's right. So I took a look at the timeline of contributions that Bloom Energy gave to Newsom. And in December 2019, they contributed $31,000 to Governor Newsom. Just a couple months later, in March, Newsom reached out to the company and said, hey, can you help refurbish these ventilators that are important to the pandemic response? And the company said, sure, we'll give it a shot. It wasn't their comfort zone, so to speak, of, you know, manufacturing, but they said they'd do it. The contract was worth $1 million, bumped up to $2 million, and that was a no-bid contract, just awarded to them directly by the state. And then in October 2020, just a few months later, they contributed $25,000 to Newsom. And it's worth noting also that in this example and in others as well, Newsom went out of his way to tout the partnerships that the state had formed with these companies, either during press conferences. In this example with Bloom, he actually went to the facility to hold one of his press conferences and essentially show and display Bloom's work, which gained it quite a bit of media attention internationally. So that's one example of this timeline of contributions and no-bid contracts lining up.
Hmm. Well, so I remember just early on in the pandemic, there was a mad scramble to get ventilators and this kind of PPE as well. And it was, you know, the state needed to act fast. is that the other side of this argument, that here are these companies that have stepped forward immediately and said, okay, we can do it now, and the governor said, okay, go for it?
Absolutely. I mean, there's no doubt that at the beginning of this pandemic, the state needed to act quickly. And under states of emergency, the state has the ability to enter into contracts either on a no-bid basis or on a fast-tracked basis. And, you know, that's happening during this pandemic, but it happens during things like wildfires as well. So, you know, the governor's office responded to me in an emailed comment, and I'll read part of it directly because I think it's important. They said, quote, "The governor's administration made the decision to enter into all contracts related to the COVID-19 response based on the best interests of the state and protecting health and welfare of all our residents," end quote. And they said, you know, we needed to move quickly to stand up these services, to acquire these resources at the start of the pandemic, because, you know, we're looking at a potential surge in cases. We're looking at potentially overwhelmed hospitals. So that's the argument on the other side.
Right. What does this mean for the recall effort and whether or not the democratically controlled legislature would be willing to launch an investigation?
So, frankly, this is sort of red meat for the recall campaign. I spoke with folks who are part of the recall effort, and they said, well, this is in line with what we've been saying for months now, that we believe the governor is not transparent, he's not forthright with the public in his actions. And so it's been discussed and shared pretty widely sort of in the recall circles and also among Republican elected officials and folks who are, you know, on the Republican side seeking office. Kevin Kiley, who's a Republican lawmaker at the Capitol, he called for an investigation into Newsom and into these the overlap of these contributions and no-bid contracts. However, in reaching out to the offices of Democratic lawmakers yesterday and today, it doesn't seem like there's an appetite there to sort of go out on that limb. And frankly, an investigation won't happen without bipartisan support. And, you know, earlier in the pandemic, we saw some Democratic lawmakers who were willing to criticize the governor in entering into some contracts, for example, the BYD contract that was worth up to $1 billion or more than $1 billion now with an extension. There was some criticism there from folks in his own party. But right now, you're not seeing that, especially, you know, as the recall effort has been coalescing and looking more and more like it has a shot of actually materializing.
Scott Rodd, state government reporter for Cap Radio, and you can read more about his investigation into Newsom's donors at capradio.org. Scott, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, how Rush Limbaugh transformed American media. NPR's David Folkenflik is here with an assessment next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Rush Limbaugh, the fire-breathing talk show host who redefined right-wing AM radio, died today at the age of 70. His widow, Catherine, announced his death on his program, calling her late husband passionate and courageous. But Limbaugh also leveled hateful attacks on lots of people, liberals, women, people of color, the LGBTQ community. Here's a sampling of what we've heard over the years on his radio show, and we should warn you, what you're about to hear is disturbing. It's racist, sexist, pure Rush.
Al Sharpton goes out and in the front door.
Hollywood leftists bailing out. People put in jail during the
riots.
Yes,
I spoke a little Negro dialect there.
It's not about lesbian farmers.
A coup launched in the Oval Office of Barack Obama. What do they think modern era feminazism is about?
Nevertheless, former President Donald Trump awarded Limbaugh the Presidential Medal of Freedom on live television last year during the State of the Union. We're going to talk about Limbaugh's legacy with NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Hey, David.
Hey, Madeline. Great to join you.
Great to have you. Well, his widow did say that he was larger than life, which is accurate. How larger than life was he? What, if you could sum it up, what was he in American media?
You know, I think it's he's one of these classic figures who in some ways foreshadowed and helped trigger the blurring of the lines in the modern age between the media and politics. And I think that he also helped to really erase lines between journalism and some sort of, you know, infotainment, as I think it was Harry Scherer who called it. He trafficked in ideological attacks and also ideological calls to action and summonses. He gave a voice, I think it is fair to say, to a significant portion of a potential radio audience that felt that they weren't being listened to or spoken for or spoken with. And so he tapped into something that was in some ways real and in some ways manufactured. And in so doing, he kind of laid the groundwork for Fox. I think you could argue he showed a path for, you know, some of the even crazier figures like Alex Jones, who trafficked in even purer, more explicitly in conspiracy theories. And he, I think, showed a path for Donald Trump as well in a variety of ways, including but not limited to the kinds of rhetoric that we just heard at the montage at the top of the segment.
Right. And so he was enormously powerful in terms of rallying his tens of millions of listeners, daily listeners. And how influential was he, though, in terms of pure politics in Washington? Did he have the ear of presidents, of senators?
Well, you know, he was somebody that the Republicans started to really pay attention to in the late Reagan years. George H.W. Bush in 92 turned to him. He wasn't a kind of natural fit. George Bush, a much more patrician establishment figure, but realized he had to, in some ways, bring Limbaugh and the kinds of listeners he brought with him into the fold. And then in 1994. Whether it was in some ways legend or whether it was fact, Limbaugh was given great credit for helping to energize the foot soldiers of Newt Gingrich in taking back the House of Representatives for the Republicans for the first times in four decades. They assigned him to be an honorary member of the freshman class that took office in January of 95. And as a result, he became an arbiter of what voices should be elevated to the national level, which particularly mattered with not only voters but donors in the Republican Party in the 1990s, and became kind of arm-in-arm with Gingrich and other Republican forces in those years. And so that was important. His legacy on talk radio was that it became, you know, the fairness doctrine gets cast aside by Reagan in the mid-80s, and Limbaugh sort of leans heavily into that. He sort of dove into it like an Acapulco diver, you know, in that he said, that's fine. I'm going to have a point of view. You're not going to be having to parse it closely to figure out where I stand. I'm going to bellow it at you, and I'm going to do it in a way that rallies people. He kind of owned the libs before that was really a phrase that existed. And to do so, he did some of the things that you just heard. He trafficked in racist and sexist and homophobic and other kinds of, you know, what do you say, bigoted stereotypes to do that in ways that he was occasionally apologetic for, but basically unrepentant for. He said, you know, I don't really like to apologize for it. I like to make my point clearly so that listeners know what I'm trying to say.
Right. And he did pick on people who were weak in many instances. He picked on people with disabilities, Michael J. Fox, for example, people with AIDS. Yet he himself suffered from drug addiction in a big way. He was caught doctor shopping, and he apparently suffered hearing loss later in his career. And many think it was because of his addiction to prescription painkillers. So did he ever kind of modulate that and think, OK, well, I understand weakness now?
You know, by sharing what he went through to a degree with his opioid addiction, and by talking about at a certain point openly about his hearing loss, he humanized himself for listeners and showed you that he wasn't just at the mountaintop throwing thunderbolts. And in a way, I think that connected him more closely with his audience and not just with the ditto heads who might agree with him on everything. What it didn't do, at least in times when I listened to him, was impart on him a great deal of empathy for other people coming with similar kinds of frailties, or particularly with different ones that might be analogous, who didn't happen to agree with him on the issues or might be critical of him in other ways. It didn't allow him. You know, empathy was not only was not a strong suit. I don't think it was in the closet, And so it just wasn't a tool that he had. And I don't think that those afflictions, while real, gave him broader insight into the human condition. I think it gave us some insight into what it was like to be him. And there were times where he said, this is about much more than me. And he said at the end, when he acknowledged that he had terminal cancer, he said, you know, what you guys are going through is more important than what I am. And in a sense, that was a very human moment.
Well, David, thank you.
You bet.
David Folkenflik, NPR's media correspondent. We've been talking about Rush Limbaugh, who died today at the age of 70. Coming up, how the media treated young female celebrities and their sexuality in the late 90s, early 2000s. Not just Britney, but Paris Hilton, Jessica Simpson, Monica Lewinsky.
What they all talk about, you know, after all these years away from the spotlight, when they, you know, like I said, needed a break, it's like they come back and say, you know, this really traumatized me. This had after effects that long outlasted the actual attention itself.
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. We're going to talk now about Britney Spears. For a lot of people, she's just another bubblegum pop star undone by fame. But her story is really a much larger one about how America treats its stars, especially young women. During her heyday, Spears was relentlessly pursued by the paparazzi. Practically every time she left her house, she was besieged by photographers.
Where are you going, Brittany?
Sorry about that,
Brittany.
I'm
right
a
now?
Person just like you.
Why don't you take one right now?
Your people.
Can you take a picture of us, Brittany?
Well, finally, she cracked, ended up involuntarily hospitalized, and now her career and fortune are under the control of her father. This story is told in a new New York Times documentary called Framing Britney Spears. It's out now on Hulu. But Britney is not the only celebrity from that era now being reevaluated. Paris Hilton, Lindsay Lohan, Monica Lewinsky, all judged by different standards at the time than men. And here to talk about this is Ashley Fetters. She covers pop culture at The Washington Post. Hi.
Hi, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, the time period we're talking about is roughly late 90s to early 2000s, like right before the big recession. Set the scene for us. What was the paparazzi pop star relationship like back then?
Well, there's a couple of things that are worth keeping in mind about this particular, I like to call it the Y2K era, those late 90s, early 2000s, right? So number one, I think, I mean, this is pointed out in the Framing Britney Spears documentary, you know, by the critic at large for the Times, Wesley Morris, Monica Lewinsky and Bill Clinton's affair had just created a huge tabloid scandal right when people like Britney Spears and kind of her cohort of young, beautiful, you know, pop stars in their teens and early 20s came to prominence. And so we were in this moment in America where sex and young women's sexual desires in particular were being discussed very openly and very frankly and very, I would say, scornfully. So of course, like, we were in a place where, you know, it was expected that, or it was kind of, you know, people were primed to talk about this when they talked about celebrities and young women in the spotlight. So that kind of primed some of these, you know, some of these things that we're looking back on now as kind of horrifying, right? I think the second thing to keep in mind is that this is also the moment when reality TV culture really had started to take hold. This was a time when a lot of celebrities were participating in the reality TV trend. Anna Nicole Smith, for example, had opened up her life to the cameras. Paris Hilton was on The Simple Life. Jessica Simpson had Newlyweds. Britney Spears herself briefly had a reality show while she was married to Kevin Federline. And so there was sort of this idea in the 2000s that part of being a celebrity was opening your whole personal life to consumers and people who were interested, just from a, you know, from a civilian level. And then I think the third thing to sort of understand about this era is that tabloids at the time, this tabloid industry was booming, and, you know, celebrity magazines and paparazzi, it was just a huge industry. You could make so much money off a single shot of a celebrity kind of living their daily life, right? You could take a $500,000 paycheck for the right photo of the right celebrity. So, you know, all this kind of added up to something that was a real burden on celebrities at the time that I don't think we recognized while we lived through it.
Right, because there's always that thought that they benefited too. Sometimes they would actually alert the paparazzi when they were going to go out to a certain place to have them, and they would be waiting there for them because it helped their careers too, especially with some of the celebrities who didn't really have anything in particular to market, like a Paris Hilton, for example. Mm-hmm. It was seen as, they liked all the attention.
Yeah, that's true. And I think to some extent that's absolutely true and still true. You know, you do have to be generating some attention to continue to maintain attention and continue to maintain eyeballs in your career. But I do think that we reached sort of a fever pitch of invasiveness in that Y2K era.
Right. So all these things conspire for, as you say, this to become a fever pitch moment. And then you see Britney Spears crack. She shaves her head. She attacks one paparazzo's car. And then she's involuntarily hospitalized as well. And so I guess, and she fades from view. And a lot of the other celebrities of that era have faded from view. And why is that? Was it because of the recession and we had different priorities? We weren't as interested in frothy celebrity culture?
I think that's a piece of it. I do think that, you know, the immediate fade from view was probably that a lot of these folks just needed a break. We saw that very clearly with Britney Spears, and I think, you know, lots of other folks needed the same break that she did. She sent signals for a long time that she needed to be left alone. You know, I think the head shaving was part of that, and I don't think it was understood to be, you know, a signal of leave me alone the way we understand mm-hmm. it to be now. So I think that's part of it, and I think another piece of this is, you know, social media really gave celebrities themselves the tools to, if they wanted to put their personal lives on display, they could do it on their own terms, on their own time, kind of in the way that they wanted to. And, you know, someone I think of as sort of emblematic of this is Chrissy Teigen, right? She is someone mm-hmm. who has been very vocal about, you know, some of the hard things that happened to her and, this, you know, some of the funny things that happened to her. She Instagrams her kids all the time. And, you know, these are the kinds of things that tabloids used to chase after celebrities trying to get. And instead she's saying, no, here, have it. Just leave us alone when we want our privacy.
Right. And I guess the Kardashians as well would also be emblematic of that, of being able to control their image.
Yeah, I think the Kardashians really have like straddled the two eras here, right? Like they started out in the tabloid paparazzi era and then really took control of it. They really just really repurposed it for their own motivations.
As I was watching this documentary, this Britney Spears documentary, I was really surprised to come face to face with a different perspective on the prevailing idea of who Britney Spears was, and by extension, who all these young women were. As you mentioned, a lot of it has to do with their sexuality, and, you know, or there's mm-hmm. the sex tape involved with Paris Hilton and others. And there was just so much slut shaming going on, so much investigation into their sexuality. And I just want to play a clip of Diane Sawyer right now from the documentary where she is interviewing Britney Spears.
Britney Spears has upset a lot of mothers in this country, starting with the wife of the governor of Maryland.
Really, if I had an opportunity to shoot Britney Spears, I think I would.
Oh, that's horrible. Well, that's really bad.
Because of the example for kids and how hard it is to be a parent.
Well, that's really sad that she said that. Ew. I'm not here to, you know, babysit her kid.
Yeah. She's an adult. But it was the whole idea of Britney Spears as portraying herself as a young girl in her videos and yet also being a sexy young girl with her bare midriff and the way she danced. And that seemed to upset a lot of people. Can you talk about that, about how almost puritanical the culture was when it came to these young women?
What strikes me listening to that Diane Sawyer clip is, you know, when she says, I'm not here to babysit her kids, I remember hearing that at the time. And I remember that was kind of framed as just a rude thing to say. Like, mm-hmm. oh, I don't want to be a role model. And I remember that was kind of condemned as like, no, you're a celebrity. This is part of your job. And, you know, I look back on that and I kind of think that was unfair. You know, I obviously we're looking at somebody who came to prominence and, you know, really was under public scrutiny to a, you know, excruciating degree from a really young age. And, you know, you think about the lives of civilian people, right? When we're 18, 19, 20, in our early 20s, we are discovering, you know, our sex lives. We are kind of starting to think about, you know, ourselves as sexual beings. And that's, you know, that's the time in life when you do that. And that is a time when, you know, it directly coincided with Britney Spears being extremely famous, which, you know, it when I think about it now, it just seems like such a bummer to have, you know, your mm-hmm. decisions and your life experiences like that be under so much shame and scrutiny from folks like, you know, this Diane Sawyer interview kind of brings to light just how many people were talking about this and really condemning her personal choices, I think. So, yeah, I mean, I think we were definitely in a place that, again, this comes back to the post Clinton Lewinsky scandal. Like, we had, you know, just had this national reckoning with, you know, the the harmful power of temptation, right? And so we really kind of swung the opposite direction in terms of, you know, we got to keep this out of our daily lives. We got to keep this out of our kids' lives. And I think, you know, that was very emblematic at the time.
Right. And yet there was this other insatiable desire to read all about it and pry into her private life and mm-hmm. get all the sort of details in the tabloids, in the Us Weeklies, yeah. and all those magazines. Yeah.
It was this very strange combination of prurient and shaming,
which the boy bands at the time were not undergoing.
No, no, you know, none of the young boy band members who were such a big deal at the time were undergoing any of the same kind of scrutiny that Britney Spears and other young women were.
And so we're reevaluating how we treated her. We're reevaluating other pop stars and other celebrities. Paris Hilton came out with her own documentary in which she talked about being abused. And I guess I'm wondering why this is all happening now.
I think right now we are in a moment of reflection squarely directed at 20 to 25 years ago. There's a business sense to that. Like, people who are mm-hmm. in that key 18 to 34 demographic right now are eager to sort of re-examine with adult eyes the things that they sort of absorbed in fragments from childhood. You know, I'm in that demographic myself, and it is interesting to me to say, you know, I remember seeing snippets of this on TV when I was 7, and now that I'm in my 30s, I'm kind of like, oh, this was a totally different thing than I remember. So I do think we're reevaluating a lot of pop culture from, you know, the 90s and 2000s right now, just out of, you know, backward-looking interest. But I do think one of the big takeaways has been just that the treatment of women was just really dehumanizing. Lots of young women, especially, I think, were really treated as punchlines instead of people. You know, you mentioned mm-hmm. Paris Hilton had that documentary that came out last year. And what people like Paris Hilton and, you know, Jessica Simpson had a book last year that came out, and Monica Lewinsky gave this TED Talk a few years ago. And what they all talk about, you know, after all these years away from the spotlight, when they, you know, like I said, needed a break, it's like they come back and say, you know, this really traumatized me. This had after effects that long outlasted the actual attention itself.
And there is the Me Too movement, which also reframed how we look at celebrities and what we as a culture do to them, women in particular.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that was another opportunity for, you know, celebrities to kind of reclaim their place as humans, right? They're
right.
You know, that they're vulnerable to a lot of the same things that the rest of us are, especially, you know, predatory sexual behaviors or inappropriate advances from people we work with, right? Like, these are things that just because you're famous, you aren't immune to. And I think that really, I think that's a great point that the Me Too movement kind of humanized celebrities in a way that, you know, we hadn't seen before.
Yeah. Do you ever wonder what's going to happen 20 years from now, like how we're going to reevaluate the way we talk about cultural figures today, especially women?
Yes, I do. I mean, I think what's really coming to light right now, with the benefit of hindsight and with the benefit of having had, you know, now a few years of famous people, celebrities, talking openly about mental health as something that is a priority and a vulnerability, what's coming to light is just how much, you know, Britney Spears and her personal struggles in the 2000s and so many other young women like her, is how much that resulted from being persistently hounded and harassed and belittled by not just the tabloids, but by the mainstream press, you know, people who were, you know, reporting for credible high profile outlets. And I think this documentary really paints this really well. It spells out to a lot of people that, you know, just about anybody could justifiably have a, you know, a meltdown or have a breakdown or have, you know, so a really hard time if this were their life.
Absolutely. I definitely came away from it with a lot more sympathy for Britney Spears than I had going into it, for sure.
I think a lot of people did. And, you know, I think it's always good to kind of look back at things with, you know, this eye toward how could this have been handled better? And I really think this is a great opportunity to do that.
Well, thank you, Ashley.
Thank you so much, Madeline. It's been really fun talking to you.
You too. That's Ashley Fetter. She covers pop culture for The Washington Post. And you can check out the Britney Spears documentary on Hulu. Coming up, a lot of offices have been closed since March because of COVID. What happened when one woman went back to check on her office? Well, she found it wasn't entirely empty. Insects had taken over. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. A lot of us have not set foot in an office in, well, almost a year now. Dust has accumulated, desk calendars turned to March of 2020, a time capsule of the before times. But life seems to find a way, and when people move out, the critters move in. That's what happened at a Santa Barbara tech startup over the course of the past year. Susan Arango works for a software company called Invoca, and she's one of the few people who actually has been on site from time to time since the beginning of the pandemic, and she found, get this, a colony of tens of thousands of honeybees that took up residence in her building's walls. Susan's here now to talk about it. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. I'm sure you didn't expect that when you went back to check up on things in your office, a honeybee infestation. So let's talk about when you first discovered this. Your company was fully remote, right? It went remote in March. You went back at some point to check on things and?
Well, so it was in April, so maybe about a month or so after we went remote. And I had to go into the office just to check on things. And I noticed some dead bees. And I thought, oh, okay, well, that makes sense. We had a windstorm. So I'm like, okay, I didn't really think anything of it.
Yeah. But then you found out that no, it was not that at all.
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, I cleaned it up. And then, you know, I probably went back a couple of weeks later and then realized more dead bees. Okay, this is fishy. What's going on? Anyways, nobody was there in the building. So I really honestly felt, okay, well, it's not bugging anyone. So I just sort of come in and clean it up. And then there be bees again. And finally, then in like December and January, I was just like, you know what? I really need to figure this out. So I had to look up on the internet to see if I could find someone who could figure that out for me. So, and that's when I found Super Bee Rescue and Removal.
That's what they're called, Super Bee Rescue and Removal.
Oh yeah. And their logo is pretty cute. It's like this bee with, and he's got goggles on, you know, and he's like a superhero bee. And so I called them up and I knew that there are these operations that would not kill them because I didn't want to kill the bees. And they said, yeah, we'll go out and take a look. And this was now January, so 2021. The woman who came out, Tracy, she literally in 5 minutes found where they were coming out of.
Really? Well, I guess it's her job.
It's her job, right? And I felt pretty dumb, but it was a small hole inside the brick where they were flying in and out. It wasn't a swarm of bees, but she just sort of like looked way high up. And she could see that there's a few bees coming in and out of this hole. And she's like, I bet you that's where they're coming in. And sure enough, she went then through the inside of the building and used this like special device that picks up the heat because bees create a lot of heat.
Yeah, they are, after all, very busy.
Right. Very busy. And they're radiating all this heat from all of their work they're doing, making honey and, you know, feeding the babies and all of that. So basically, she found the location where she thought they were, and she had to get inside the wall, make a hole in the bathroom on the second floor. Then she had to like work her way through this like attic. Then she cut out a 3x3 size piece of like wood. She cut it open and there was this ginormous hive.
Oh my gosh. That sounds like a horror movie. Like, You'd hear the music swell at that point as soon as she saw that huge hive.
It's intense. And then when she was able to remove all the bees, I saw them and it literally was something out of like that Fear Factor show where you have to go inside and you're just fighting for your life. Like, please don't sting me.
How big was it, that hive?
She said with everything that she pulled out, so honeycomb, bees, everything, 10 gallons worth of stuff. And she thought approximately about 20,000 bees, hit or miss.
Wow.
Yeah. And she found the queen bee.
Oh, she did?
Yeah, she got the queen bee.
And what was the queen doing in there? Just hanging out, having a good time?
All they do is lay babies. This woman, Tracy, who is the technician, she really knew her stuff. And so she shared a lot of information with me about what the life of a bee is like. And basically the queen does nothing but make babies, pops babies out.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's quite a life. And then lots and lots of honey. So you had 10 gallons of stuff, including tons of honey. So that's good.
Yeah. No, it was pretty cool. So what's really neat about it is they push this smoke that sort of like makes them kind of hazy, and they end up blowing this smoke in, and then they have them go into this box, and this box then has the pheromones of a queen bee. So they just naturally, like in their dazed and confused state, the bees will fly into this box.
That's how they're caught.
That's how they're caught. Yeah.
In this box, they're all drowsy and they go into this box, and then she ferries them away, including the queen.
Yes. I assume. Including the queen. And then basically what they do is they take that box and they put it out in an area that's free of like people and stuff like that. And they reconstruct the hive. So that's how they survive.
So you saved the bees, or she saved the bees. She saved the queen. You got some honey out of it, although you had a big hole in your wall, but oh well.
Yes. I didn't keep the honey though, because it was kind of weird. She gave me a piece that was probably the size of a dinner plate. And it was basically like raw honeycomb with honey in it. And I like honey, but it was a little too much for me. So I told a coworker what was happening, and he gladly took it off my hands. And he said it was really good.
I think you have to strain it or something. You can't just eat it with the bits of waxy stuff in there. It's not nice.
I don't know. I know people that eat that raw honeycomb stuff. I don't know, but.
Wow. So that is, you received quite a lesson in the power of nature. Yes.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And they did find another old hive that apparently had been, I mean, who knows how old, but it was dead. It had been left by another colony. So clearly they've been there before.
So they might return again. Susan, what if they come back? What are you going
to
do?
They won't be able to, because now we walked the building now and we found a couple of other holes in the walls, and those are all going to be covered up with like a mesh little covering on there. No more bees.
No more bees. What did Tracy, your bee lady, say about why it appears that your building is so attractive to bees?
She said that bees do have memory and they do have a good sense of smell. So they probably could tell that there was another beehive from the past in there, but, she pretty much said that it was probably a good guess on my part was after the wind event that we had back last year in April, that particular colony was displaced, and then they just go crazy trying to find another little nook where they can be safe.
Right. And no humans there except for you.
Exactly.
To bother them, and they could live peaceably and make their honey and live their lives. Sounds nice.
Exactly.
Don't you think that you should have let the bees stay and you guys could just clear out of there?
Yeah, clear out and just really made a whole like bee, you know, honey factory within our walls. <Yeah. bottle. laughs>
Why not? That sounds nice, actually.
Yeah.
So your title is Workplace Experience Manager. So
correct.
That's quite the experience you had.
Yes. I never in a million years would have thought that I would be doing that as part of my job.
Well, these are strange times.
Yes.
Well, Susan, thanks for the story. And Good luck with any future infestations.
Oh gosh, let's hope not. We'll just keep it there.
Susan Arango, Workplace Experience Manager for Invoca up in Santa Barbara. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, gonna buzz off now. I'll see you tomorrow.